This is Audible.
ISIS Audiobooks presents an unabridged recording of The Siege, written by Helen Dunmore, read by Gilly Bond. Naval Staff, Berlin, 29th September 1941. Top Secret. Re: The Future of Leningrad. The Führer has decided to have Leningrad wiped from the face of the earth. The further existence of this large town is of no interest once Soviet Russia is overthrown. Finland has also similarly declared no interest in the continued existence of the city directly on her new frontier. The original demands of the Navy that the shipyard, harbour and other installations vital to the Navy be preserved are known to the Armed Forces High Command. But in view of the basic principles underlying the operation against Leningrad, it is not possible to comply with them. The intention is to close in on the city and blast it to the ground by bombardments of artillery of all calibers and by continuous air attacks. Requests that the city may be handed over, arising from the situation within, will be turned down, for the problem of the survival of the population and of supplying it with food is one which cannot and should not be solved by us. In this war for existence, we have no interest in keeping even part of this great city's population. Naval Staff. From the Führer Directives and Other Top-Level Directives of the German Armed Forces, 1939 to 1941. The original U.S. Army translation from the German is held in the Naval War College, Newport, Rhode Island, USA. With thanks to the Militärgeschichtliches Forschungsamt, Potsdam, Germany. Chapter 1. June 1941. It's 10:30 in the evening, but the light of day still glows through the lime leaves. They are so green that they look like an hallucination of the summer everyone had almost given up expecting. When you touch them, they're fresh and tender. It's like touching a baby's skin. Such a late spring, murky and doubtful, clinging to winter skirts. But this is how it happens here in Leningrad. Under the trees around the Admiralty, lakes of spongy ice turned grey. There was slush everywhere, and a raw, dirty wind off the Neva. There was a frost, a thaw, another frost. Month after month, ice fishermen crouched by the holes they drilled in the ice, sitting out the winter, heads hunched into shoulders. And then, just when it seemed as if summer would forget about Leningrad this year, everything changed. Ice broke loose from the compacted mass around the Strelka. Seagulls preened on the floes as the current swept them under bridges and down the widening Neva to the sea. The river ran full and fast, with a fresh wind tossing up waves so bright they stung your eyes. Everything that was rigid was crumbling, breaking away, floating. People leaned on the parapets of the Dvartsovy Bridge, watching the ice floes rock as they passed under the arch. Their winter world was being destroyed. They wanted spring, of course they wanted it, more than anything. They longed for sun with every pore of their skin. But spring hurts. If spring can come, if things can be different, how can you bear what your existence has been? These are hard times. Leningrad's been tougher than ever since 1937. Food shortages, grey-faced kids, frightened men and women scuttling in the dusty wind. Peter's great buildings hang over them, crushingly magnificent. In times like these, the roads are too wide. How long it takes to fight your way across Peter's squares and how visible you become. Yes, you're a target and you don't know who's watching. So many disappearances, so much fear. Black vans cruise the streets. You listen for the note of their engines and your heart pumps until it chokes you as the van slows. But it passes this time and halts at the doorway to another courtyard where you don't live. You hear the van doors clang, and the sweat of relief soaks you shamefully. Some other poor bastard is in that van this time. Spring stripped everything bare. It showed the grey and weary skin of everyone over 30. It lit up lips set in suffering, with wrinkles pulling sharply at the corners of the mouth. but the lime tree's bare branches were spiked by the glitter of sunlight and birdsong. The birds had no doubts at all. They sang out loudly and certainly into the still frozen world. They knew that winter was on the move. Now it's June, and night is as brief as the brush of a wing, only an hour of yellow stars in a sky that never darkens beyond deep, tender blue. No one sleeps. Crowds surge out of cafes and wander the streets, not caring where they go as long as they can lift their faces and drink the light. It's been dark for so many months. A line of young men, arm in arm, drunk, stern with the effort of keeping on their feet, sways on the corner of Universitskaya Embankment and Lieutenant Schmidt's bridge. They won't go home. They can't bear to part from one another. They'll walk, that's what they'll do, from one end of the city to another, from island to island, across stone bridges and shining water. These are the nights that seal each generation of Leningraders to their city. These nights are their baptism. The summer light will flood every grain of Leningrad stone, as it floods every cell of their own bodies. At 3 o'clock in the morning, in full sun, they'll find themselves in some back street of little wooden houses, miles from anywhere. There'll be a cat licking its paws in a doorway, a lime tree with electric green leaves hanging over a high wooden fence, and an old woman slowly making her way down the street with a little bunch of jasmine pinned to her jacket. Each flower will be as white and distinct as a star against the shabby grey. And she'll smile at the young men, as if she's their grandmother. She won't disapprove of their drunkenness, their shouting and singing. She'll understand exactly how they feel. However old you are, you can't stay indoors on a night like this. It stirs again the promise and recklessness of white nights. Peter's icy, blood-sodden marshes bear up the city like a swan. The swan's wings are still folded, but they are trembling in the summer light, stirring and getting ready to fly. Darkness scarcely touches them. The wind breathes softly. Water laps under the midnight bridges. And suddenly you know that there's no greater possible happiness than to be here, even when you're so old you're beyond walking. You lean out of your apartment window with stiff joints and fading strength over the city that will outlive you. But Anna is not in Leningrad tonight. She's out in the country, at the dacha, alone with her father and Kolya. She doesn't belong in the crowds of students celebrating the end of their examinations. She doesn't share the jokes anymore, or know which books everyone's reading. Hers is a daylight city of trams packed with overworked mothers, racing from work to food queue to kitchen and back again. The white nights rouse up too many longings. Anna has a duty to crush them. She has 5-year-old Kolya, her job at the nursery, and her responsibilities. It's no good letting herself dream of student life. She'll never have long days in a studio, mind and body trained on the movement of hand across paper. It's no good remembering what it was like to be 17, only 6 years ago, with graduation from school a year ahead of her, and a crowd of friends round the table at the Europe, packed together, laughing and talking so loudly that you could hardly hear what anyone said. The words didn't matter. The noise of happiness was what mattered, and the warmth of someone else's arm pressed against yours. There was a smell of sunburnt skin, coffee, cigarettes and marigolds. Don't think about all that. She's at the dacha, leaning out of the window and resting her elbows on warm, silver-grey wood. It's very quiet. Behind her, Kolya sleeps in his cot bed. They have a bedroom divided in two by a plywood partition, one half for her father, the other for Anna and Kolya. Downstairs, the living room opens onto the veranda. Every sound echoes in the dacha's wooden shell. But to have a dacha at all is luxury. There's no chance of her father ever qualifying for a dacha at the writer's colony, but they have held on to this little place, which once belonged to Anna's grandmother. They come here whenever they can in summer, when the city's airless and full of dust. Anna bikes it on the precious, battered bike that was her mother's, with Kolya tied onto his seat behind her. Anna does most of the cooking outside, on the veranda. She chops onions, kneads pastry for meat pies, peels potatoes, prepares sausage. She even makes jam outside, on the little oil stove. All through each summer, Anna builds up stores for the winter. She gives grammar and handwriting lessons to the Sokolov children at the farm in exchange for honey, jars of goose fat, and goat's cheese. She dries mushrooms and makes jams and jellies from the fruit she and Kolya pick. Lingonberries, blueberries, raspberries, blackberries, wild strawberries. She buys a drink made from fermented birch sap, which is packed with vitamins and said to be particularly good for asthmatic children, like Kolya. Then there are red cabbages to be pickled, onions to be tied into strings, garlic to be plaited, beans to be preserved in brine, potatoes to be brushed free of earth, sorted, then brought back to the apartment, sack by sack, strapped to the back of her bike. You have to be careful with potatoes, because they bruise more easily than you think, and then they won't keep. Anna doesn't know how she'd have got them through the last two winters without produce from the dacha. Not only are there food shortages all the time, but her father can't get his work published. He survives by translating, but even that might dry up. Editors have got their own families to consider. Her father's near-perfect French and German are dangerous assets now. He can't help speaking like someone who has spent time abroad. A year in Heidelberg in 1912, a summer in Lausanne. He could be pulled in for questioning, as an individual with foreign contacts. Her father wanted to take it lightly the first time one of his stories was rejected. He was asked to appear in front of a magazine committee, where the shortcomings of his story were explained to him. They told him that his tone was pessimistic. He had failed to take on board and reflect in his work the principles drawn from Stalin's speech of the 1st of December 1935. Life has become better, comrades. Life has become more cheerful.
And yet in your story, Mikhail Ilyich, there is no sense that any of the characters are making headway. Publication of this work would do nothing to advance your reputation. In fact, it would damage it.
"Frankly, we were surprised that you submitted it, Mikhail Ilyich," said the chairman of the committee. "We try to be understanding, but really in this case it's impossible, as I'm sure you'll agree."
And he chucked the manuscript face down on the table, lightly, pityingly, humorously, just as he would have done if a schoolboy had submitted his outpourings to a top literary magazine and expected to get them published.
"No, we can't have this kind of stuff."
He twinkled at Mikhail, begging him to see the joke. Other members of the committee looked down at their blotters or played with their pens. Their faces were dark with the resentment we feel towards those we are about to injure. Mikhail looked at the familiar faces. A flush of hot blood ran under his skin. Was the shame in himself, standing there with his unwanted manuscript, unable to accept the criticism of his contemporaries? The room itself seemed washed with shame. Even his story was stained with it.
"No," he muttered. "I should never have brought it here."
"Exactly so," said the chairman, rising. "But allow me to say, dear Mikhail Ilyich, that I've always been an admirer of your work. All you need is a little..." His fingers sketched adjustments. "A little less gloom and doom. That's not what people want these days. That's not what we're here to do."
He smiled, showing white, strong teeth in healthy gums. The room prickled with agreement. The room knew what was wanted these days. Mikhail continued to submit stories, which were always rejected. One evening, a colleague from the Writers' Union appeared at the apartment. "Don't send anything else in just now. It's for your own good, Mikhail Ilyich."
"I'm writing as I've always written."
"Yes, that's it. That's exactly it. Do you really not see? We all have to make adjustments.
They are good stories.
For God's sake, what has that got to do with anything?"
On his way out, he paused. He was waiting for something, but Mikhail couldn't think what. After the man had gone, it dawned. He'd expected to be thanked. We'd taken a risk. He'd tried to help. Not many did that these days, because it was too dangerous. Each person taken in for questioning could drag 100 more down.
Who was in the room with you when this occurred? Their names. Write them here.
Better put it in the drawer, Anna's father would say as he types out the final draft of a new story. His fingers pecked at the keys. He'd never learned to type properly. When Vera was alive, she typed for him. Let the drawer read it.
Well, here we are, Anna. I'm back to my youth again, pouring out rubbish that nobody wants to print. People pay thousands for rejuvenation treatments, don't they? I could sell my secret.
His attempts at humour make her wince. All this is changing him, month by month. It's scouring him out from the inside. He even walks differently. Anna can't think what it all reminds her of. Then one day she's at work, and she sees little Serioja hide behind the bins as a gang of big boys charges round the playground, windmilling their arms, bellowing, knocking into everyone. They're the gang. They're the ones who count. Serioja shrinks against the wall. In the nursery you can sort it out. You can break up the gang. You can put your arm around Serioja. There, in her little world within a world, things still make sense.
But then out comes her boss, Elizaveta Antonovna, with the latest directives in her hand. Her eyes are fixed to the text. She has got to take the correct line. She must not make an error.
Elizaveta Antonovna doesn't even see the children. She's frightened too. The bosses are all frightened now. How should she interpret the directive? If she gets it wrong, who will inform on her?
Her father still goes to the writer's house on Ulitsa Voinova, but not very often. Although as a member of the Union of Soviet Writers, he's entitled to eat there every day.
I don't feel like it today, Anna, he says. And besides, I've got to rewrite these last two pages.
He had a dream one night. He dreamed he was lying in bed and someone clamped a hand over his mouth and nose. A firm, fleshy, well-fed hand. The fingers were thick and greasy. They squeezed his nostrils until he couldn't breathe.
What did you do?
I twisted my head from side to side to try and shake him off. But he pressed harder. And then I...
What?
I bit his hand.
I could taste his blood. Whose hand was it? And then his whisper, in the frightened room that only held the two of them.
Kobus. A nickname for Stalin.
Anna didn't answer. She knew there was more. And then I woke up. I looked in the mirror, and there were marks on my face. Dirty fingerprints. I tried to wipe them off, but they wouldn't come off. I filled a basin with water and dipped my head into it, and when I looked in the mirror, my face was streaming with water. But the marks were still there.
He looks at her. She half expects to see the fingerprints rise to the surface of his skin and show themselves. But there's nothing.
It was a dream, that's all.
I know that.
He raps it out. There she goes again, stating the obvious, not thinking before she speaks.
A nightmare, says Anna.
Don't shut the door.
No, I'll leave it open.
Her father has always been afraid of a shut door. He was afraid of getting trapped in a lift. That was why he always took the stairs. When they went to the cinema, he had to sit near the exit. Her father's income is down to a fifth of what it was 3 years ago. Each summer, Anna has increased her vegetable plot at the dacha. She's dug up all the flower beds now, except for her mother's 3 rose bushes. 3 rose trees... bearing dark red, velvety roses which open helplessly wide and spread out their perfume. Before winter, her mother packed straw around them, then sacking, and bound it with twine. Anna can see her now, the quick, expert fingers, the way she brushed soil off her knees as she stood up. There, it was done for the winter. Strange how easy it is to remember her doing that. And yet there are long, blank patches when it seems as if Anna's mother never lived at all. But she lived. Remember it. Anna and the sledge. Little Anna on her sledge long ago. Mammy loved sledging as much as Anna did. They would go out, the two of them, while Anna's father worked. He would have liked to come with them, but he had a deadline to meet.
Walking through snow, with the red sledge bumping along behind them, Anna wished that everyone she knew was there to see what a beautiful sledge she had. There were curls of green and gold on the smart, bright red. The rope was new, and Anna was allowed to pull the sledge herself. Her mother swooped down to pick up Anna when the snow went over the top of her boots. When she set her down again, Anna took up the thick, new rope. A bit farther on, near the park, someone stopped them. She stood so close that Anna smelt her smoky perfume. Her boots had shiny silver buckles on the side, and Anna wanted to touch them.
"Hasn't she grown? How are you all, Vera?"
"We're well," said Vera.
Her hand squeezed Anna's tightly. There was a silence, but Vera didn't put any more words into it.
"I haven't seen Misha for weeks. He's not ill, I hope."
Her mother's voice was steady. "He's perfectly well, Marina Petrovna. We're all perfectly well. And now, if you'll excuse me, Anna mustn't stand in the cold."
"Of course."
When Anna looked back, she was still standing there. She didn't move, and no one said goodbye. When they turned the corner, her mother stopped and placed Anna carefully on the sledge. She wrapped the shawl around Anna in the usual way, making sure that her chest was covered. But suddenly she changed and did something new. She dropped on her knees in the snow in front of the sledge. She grasped Anna and pulled her close. She pressed her tight, tight, so that Anna felt the cold of her mother's cheeks burning her.
"Mummy, you're hurting me."
Her mother moved back. Anna saw her face close up.
"Mummy, are you all right?"
Her mother stood up, brushing snow off her coat.
"I'm fine."
"Don't worry, Anna." Anna said nothing. Carefully, she tucked in the ends of the shawl, which her mother had forgotten. She looked up, and she saw that her mother's face was stiff with anger. She was drumming her fingers on the rope, staring up the street, as if she'd forgotten about Anna.
"Mummy?"
"What?"
"Can we go?"
"You want to go back home?"
"I'm cold, Mummy."
"Oh, I'm sorry. I was thinking about some things at work. Let's go. Hold on tight now, Anna."
How old was she then? 5? 6?
All through that spring and summer there was trouble hanging in the air like thunder. At night Anna woke up and there were voices slashing in the dark. When holiday time came, her mother took Anna away to the dacha, but her father didn't come with them. He had things to do in Leningrad.
"Too much work to do, Anna. I want to come, but..."
Her mother had 2 weeks' holiday, and every single minute Anna was with her. Nobody came to visit. Her mother belonged entirely to Anna. In the morning, they ate their breakfast on the veranda, and Anna put a lump of sugar in her mouth and sucked it before she drank tea, exactly as her mother did. Her mother read, while Anna cut out paper dolls and painted their clothes. Sometimes it was hot high noon before they dressed. Toys and paper scraps lay on the veranda where Anna dropped them, and 2 days later they were still there. There wasn't a breath of wind. Her mother sat on the veranda, stretched her bare feet into the sun, and read to Anna. Her mother's feet were tired and lumpy, but she stretched them like a dancer.
"Did you ever dance, Mammy?"
"Oh, yes."
"With Daddy?"
"Your father never liked dancing."
"Show me how."
"Not now, Anna. I'm reading to you."
They slept in the same bed. Anna would roll over and grasp her mother's waist, pretending to be asleep so her mother wouldn't be cross with her. She would say, in a sleepy, just woken voice,
"Mummy,
shh, go back to sleep now. It's late."
But her mother didn't push Anna away.
In Leningrad, in the apartment, there was no room for Anna in her parents' bed. Here, the old iron bedstead creaked as her mother turned over and settled to sleep, with Anna curled at her back and Anna's arm around her waist.
"Are you all right, little pigeon? Go to sleep."
"I love it when you call me little pigeon."
In the middle of the night, Anna woke. There was her mother's shoulder, warm and broad. She was turned away from Anna. Anna moved her mouth across her mother's back. She licked her mother's skin and smelled it. It smelled quite different where she licked it. Her mother tasted good. Anna swam up her mother's body until her mouth was against the soft, creamy pad of flesh behind her shoulder. She opened her mouth, and without knowing what she was going to do, she bit. Her mother startled all over, throwing Anna off. But she still didn't wake. Anna wanted her to wake. Squaring her mouth, she began to make a crying noise, and then to cry. Her mother sat up and lit the bedside candle. "Anna, what's the matter?" Her mother's plait swung forward and touched Anna's face. "Are you ill?" Anna doesn't remember any more. Her mother was herself again, calmly in charge. It was like a change in the weather. Anna settled neatly back to sleep on her own side of the bed. The next morning, before Anna had even woken, her mother had picked up all the toys, thrown away the dead flowers, and put her research papers into a pile on the table. "We go back tomorrow," her mother said. Back in Leningrad, her parents shared their bedroom again. Every night, Anna settled in her cot bed in her parents' room, and then they moved her into the living room when they went to bed. But some mornings, she woke to find her father huddled in a blanket, asleep on the leather sofa beside her. The thunder growled and rumbled, but far away so she could scarcely hear it any more. That summer at the dacha grips Anna. It keeps unpacking in her mind. 18 years ago. The only time, maybe, when her mother gave way and bound Anna to her because she needed her. But in all the years afterwards nothing was said. Never again was she as close to her mother as on those summer nights, listening to her mother's breath.
"You won't ever die, will you, Mammy?"
"One day I will," her mother said in her usual clear and serious way. "But not before you are able to live without me."
"I'll never be able to live without you."
"Of course you will.
You think you won't now, but you will."
Did Vera think of that when she was really dying? It was a postpartum hemorrhage. Neither Anna nor her father was there. Vera was unconscious and had already had a heart attack by the time they arrived. She'd been so practical about her pregnancy right from the start. Practical, realistic, and humorous with colleagues who teased her about being caught out. Vera, who wrote everything down in her small black memo book and never forgot an appointment. She stood there in her cotton maternity smock and smiled at the teasing. She said, rather oddly, "Well, none of us is immortal." "Immortal?" "No, I don't mean that, do I? What's the right word? Infallible?" "Yes, that's it." Her colleagues laughed with her. It was nice, the way Vera never tried to know everything. They suspected that maybe she'd wanted this last chance baby now that Anna was 17. After all, think how good Vera was with the younger members of the team. Always encouraging, taking time, able to teach people without them noticing it, never losing her temper when they made mistakes. But Anna knew that it was not her mother who had wanted this baby. She was 40 when she became pregnant, almost 41. She was an expert in her field and was beginning to travel, lecturing in Moscow, Odessa, Kiev.
"Are you going away again?" her father asked.
"It's only 5 days, Misha. You knew about it. It's been planned since last August. It's in the diary."
"You're never here these days."
"Anna is old enough now."
"Is that all you think about?"
Dark stains grew under Vera's eyes. Her ankles swelled so much that the straps of her sandals cut into her pale, puffy flesh. The baby was due in late summer. "Go and lie down, Mummy. I'll cook."
"It's all right, Anna, I'm fine.
I've just got to finish this." Work went on as it had always done. Vera was writing a paper which she would give at a conference in Kiev 3 months after the baby was born. Nothing was going to change, she said to her colleagues on the telephone. She would fulfil her responsibilities. When her eyes met Misha's across the room, she stared him down. Kolya's birth was easy, and immediately afterwards everything seemed fine. He was a big baby, a strong, fine child, they said to her, slapping the soles of his feet to make him cry. Vera sat up and took the baby. A nurse told Anna about it afterwards. "I want to know everything that happened," said Anna. "Don't leave anything out because you think it will upset me." The nurse looked at her, frightened.
What is it?
It's just that you sound exactly like your mother.
Anna brushed that away. Don't think of it now. Think of it later.
Go on, please.
Tell me what happened.
The delivery of the placenta was difficult. Immediately afterwards, before Vera's uterus had contracted fully, there was an emergency in the next ward. A prolapsed cord, it was. They had to leave Vera alone for a few minutes.
It was only a few minutes, Anna Mikhailovna. Well, no more than seven, I swear it.
Vera would not have been frightened when she lifted her sheet and saw blood, even though she'd have known what the bleeding meant. This was her world, the hospital world. She'd have guessed what had happened. Part of the placenta had not been expelled. Now she would continue to hemorrhage until it could be removed. The situation was urgent, but not yet dangerous. She rang a bell beside the bed. A nurse came. Vera said calmly, "I think I'm bleeding."
Is that exactly what she said?
Yes, it was me who came, you see.
Those were her words.
So Vera was frightened. She said, "I think," when she knew.
Or perhaps she didn't want to frighten the nurse.
The nurse lifted the sheet. She looked, and then she said,
"It's all right, you're fine."
And then she ran, her feet striking the hard floor all the way down the ward. Next, there was a metal trolley and porters lifting Vera onto it. The nurse ran alongside the trolley as it clattered down the corridor to the lift. Vera said she felt faint, then closed her eyes.
And then what?
Then the clean, shabby hospital wall and the shut door. Anna can't go any farther with her mother. And then there was her father, kneeling by Vera's bed with his hands over his face.
Anna touched her mother's soft, warm cheek, but the gaping face belonged to someone else. All the sense had gone out of it.
Vera was 41.
"There's always a greater risk, you understand," someone said.
But how could it be Vera who had died in this way?
It wasn't like her at all. She knew about bodies and hospitals. She understood the limits of what should happen to people. Health was her job. And her life. She knew what Anna should eat and how many hours she should study. She talked to Anna about her periods before they started, telling her just enough and not too much. "When you have children," she'd said.
"Not when I have children."
Vera's days of children were over, it went without saying. She had Anna.
But she died at 41. She left her child to Anna. In the end, instead of freeing her daughter, she put a child into her arms. That red, squirming thing they were swaddling in the next room. Kolya.
Little Anna stayed at the dacha with her mother 18 summers ago, the two of them alone together for the first time. Every night, when she woke, her mother was there, dreaming, her fist up to her face as she slept.
"Mammy," said Anna.
"It's all right," said her mother in her sleep-thickened voice.
"I'm here."
She said it every night, until Anna slept without asking. Chapter 2. As soon as the ice melted in the late spring of 41, Anna began cycling out to the dacha on her days off. It was a long ride with Kolya on the back of the bike, but she didn't mind that. She took bread and pickled herrings and bought milk for Kolya in the village. The cold, fresh air streamed over her face as she pedalled hard. She went faster, faster, her heart pumping, a smile rising from nowhere and breaking on her lips.
"Look, Kolya, look! The Sokolov farm!"
Out at the dacha, the earth was black and sweet, and it crumbled easily after the frosts. Kolya played in the dirt, making fortresses with stick-and-stone cannon, while she got the heavy digging done. She let him play, but later on he could help to plant the seeds. She was too much in the habit of doing everything for Kolya because it was quicker and easier. She'd made him lazy. An image of her father rose in her mind. His long, fine fingers turned a page, and he asked, "What time are we eating, Anna?" without even looking up from his book. He never knew what food there was in the house.
"You must be more independent, Kolya. independent, he sang to himself, swinging his feet. What's that, Anna?
He would sit there and hold out his feet for her to put his boots on, even though he knew perfectly well how to do it for himself. Anna stopped digging to watch him. He crouched over his excavations, running his gun forward, banging out fire at an invisible enemy behind the bird cherries, then digging furiously with his little wooden spade. All the while he kept up a commentary on his own game.
Attack! Attack! The reds are attacking, and the whites are retreating, their commander, fat ally, wounded.
Anna sighed. All the little boys at the nursery were the same, locked into old battles. But she kept quiet. Kolya might say something, and Elizaveta Antonovna might overhear it.
Anna says playing reds and whites is stupid.
My God, imagine if she heard that. And she might. Elizaveta Antonovna was always appearing just where you didn't expect her. Anna is a useful worker, but not useful enough for Elizaveta Antonovna to risk failing to denounce her. She wouldn't hesitate for a second. But Anna knows that for the time being she's as safe as anyone can be. She's strong, that's the main thing. She's never ill, and almost never late. She does half Luba's work as well as her own, which keeps Luba sweet. And Elizaveta Antonovna knows she'll stick at the job whatever comes, because it means she can have Kolya with her. She'll have potatoes at this end. 5 rows, that should be enough. Onions next to them. Those purple-skinned ones her father loves so much. He slices them and eats them raw, with just a sprinkling of salt. Plenty of beetroot, spinach, and little rough-skinned cucumbers for pickling. No carrots this year, after last summer's root fly. Cabbages, dill, parsley, garlic, shallots. Anna pictured the seeds beginning to stir. Plump nubs of green feeling their way up through the earth, unfolding. Fattening, changing hydrogen and oxygen and all the rest of it into solid, succulent food. Kolya looked better already, just from spending a few days outdoors after that long winter in the apartment. He was losing the waxen look of children who've been living inside sealed double windows. But that moment when the ice sheath finally loosens and the brown earth shows, long after you've given up hope that it ever will... At first, there's the stink of sour earth, which has been covered all winter with layers of ice. Before the ice melts, it grows grey and rotten. Maybe it's worth having winter, when it leads to such a spring. Kolya, don't roll in the mud like that! He stopped in his play, on all fours on the wet earth, and stared at her.
Don't talk in your nursery voice!
What?
Talk to me in your home voice!
She laughed, squatted down by him, seized his round little body in its padded jacket, and snuffed the scent of his skin. He laughed back at her, his eyes squeezed into slits. I'll show you a nursery voice.
Children, what is the meaning of this disturbance?
She grates out the words, and sees him flinch.
You sound like Elizaveta Antonovna.
Let's not talk about her.
Listen, do you know what radish seed looks like? Because I'm going to need you to plant some. Radishes, spring onions and lettuce. And then, before you know where you are, we'll be eating our first salads. Can I pick them?
First you have to plant them. We'll start in this bit over here, where I've dug. You remember, you have to rake it over carefully and then make the lines with a stick to show where the seeds have to go. They're called drills.
I know.
And then you can put in the seeds. But not all at once, mind. Just a little pinch of seed in your fingers. Like this. Kolya peered into the brown paper bags which held the seed, some of it saved from last year, some bought at the market. He poked a finger into the radish seed.
It's all dry and dead.
No, it's not dead. Don't you remember last year? Inside the seed there's a tiny germ of life, waiting until we put it in the soil. Once the sun warms it up and the rain softens it, it'll start to grow... Kolya yawned, showing the rosy inside of his mouth and his milk teeth. Never mind, Kolya. Just put the seeds in and see what happens. Maybe you'll find radishes growing by magic.
By magic, he repeated. Is this drill deep enough, Anna?
It's perfect. When the radishes are big enough, you can pull them up. You know how Dad likes them on a saucer with the leaves arranged round them? You could do that.
He'll be surprised that I grew them all by myself, won't he?
If you're going to say you grew them yourself, then you have to take care of them. Weed them, and water them if they need it. I'll show you what to do.
Macaulay was losing interest. He dumped the last of the seed into his drill.
Can I go and play?
Anna went back to the potato patch. She wasn't going to make any mistakes this year. She would plant as much as possible. As long as you've got potatoes and onions and a bit of sausage, you'll always come through.
Collier's commentary had started up again.
Attack! 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 The tanks are on their way!
After a while, she stopped hearing it. Spade into the earth. Lean forward. Press your weight down. Lift. A spadeful of earth thrust up into the light, fresh and glistening, to be turned again and broken. Worms twisted, spiders scurried, little beetles ran off the spade and plopped back onto the earth. She was getting hot. She'd take off her jacket, but Collier would want to take his off too. A blackbird sang in the lilac bushes, then another, staking out territory with all the fierceness of spring. Farther off, behind the screen of budding leaves, Anna heard someone sweeping a veranda with a broom of birch twigs, brushing with long, steady strokes into every corner so that all the muck left by the melting snow would be gone, sweeping away the winter. And now it's the 21st of June, and Anna has 4 days' holiday ahead of her. The whole garden is dug, planted, and fuzzy with green. The early crops of lettuce, radish and spring onion are coming on beautifully. She counts over her crops in her mind, like a miser counting money. She thinks of how they will be eaten during the dark months. The white lilac below Anna's window is flowering late after the cold start to the year. In the last few days, its tight cones of white bud have begun to loosen and release their perfume. A chaffinch has built its nest there, so close that if she leaned out a little farther, she could touch it. But she must hurry. It's more than 20 kilometres to Marina Petrovna's dacha, and on the forest roads that'll take at least 3 hours cycling. Marina Petrovna wants her to come at 9 o'clock.
"And for God's sake don't be late," her father said last night. "She's quite capable of refusing to see you if you are."
Marina Petrovna sees no one. This has been an article of faith for years. Sometimes her father receives a letter. "Who's that from?" Her father pauses before answering.
"Marina Petrovna."
"Don't keep it in the house, Dad, will you?" She wants to say burn it, but doesn't quite dare. At least these letters don't come through the post, so it's less of a risk. Has her father been to see Marina Petrovna? Better not ask. She is invisible, for the same reasons as Anna's father is unpublishable. She had years of fame, and then fame vanished between one day and the next. Her name was wiped from posters, programmes and reviews. But how lucky she was, considering that she'd been associated with Meyerhold as well as Tayerov. She was formally criticised by the Committee for Artistic Affairs for her inability to adequately incorporate the fundamental method into her technique, and for lack of discretion over her choice of artistic associates. She was called in for questioning, and actually released. Even a year later, she couldn't have got away with it. She'd have disappeared, along with her name. But an actress can't burrow down and work alone, hidden. She's got to have stage, cast, director, lighting, and above all, an audience. She grows older. Her best years pass, and the list of roles she's never played grows longer. She is silenced. Marina Petrovna stays in her dacha, not far from the village where she spent every summer as a child, where her old nurse still lives. Her nurse doesn't even try to understand how people who thought they were actors and poets can suddenly find they have turned into appeasers and left-right mongrels. She wipes her hands with an invisible cloth and mutters that things have always been like this. High-up people get ideas into their heads, but it's us who have to bear the brunt. So just you stay here with Nanny. Keep your head down and lie low until it's all over and done with. The dacha is only 30 kilometres from the centre of Leningrad, but it might as well be 3,000. No one is invited there.
and no one goes. Marina Petrovna doesn't push her luck. She went to ground, and they seem to have forgotten about her, but they could remember her at any time.
You have to look straight ahead. Don't look round at the black vans, or the men who climb out of them, mount the stairs with heavy boots, and stand in silence for 30 seconds before the chosen door.
Then they raise their fists and knock.
People tell themselves that the worst is over, and it's true that it's better now than in the worst of the Yezhov terror. You have to believe in something. Even in the Yezhov years, people still trusted in an unbroken record of party membership, or hoped that influence and contacts would protect them, or pretended to themselves that they still hoped and trusted. Sometimes they were released while further evidence was gathered. Fish with hooks in their mouths waiting to be jerked out of the water. Like Olya. She'd been one of Vera's colleagues. One day in the bread queue, someone tapped Anna on the back. Anna turned, stared, but did not recognize the woman.
It's me. Olya. Don't you remember me? I used to work with your mother.
Oh, yes. Yes, of course. Don't pretend.
You didn't recognize me, did you?
I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry. Would your mother recognize me, do you think?
Sometimes I think Vera had all the luck. She got away in time. No one betrayed her, and she didn't betray anybody.
Of course, Olya,
one of her mother's proteges. She was 22 when she joined the radiology department, but she looked 18, even 16. She had very short, wildly curly brown hair that everyone made excuses to touch. She was brilliantly intelligent and had been the best student of her year.
We won't keep our Olya for long, Vera had predicted. She'll go on to great things.
I lost my job,
whispered Olya in the bread queue. What are you doing?
Nothing. Just waiting. They chucked me out of the party as well. You know, Anna, work was everything to me. My colleagues were my family.
She glanced behind her, scanning the street.
I shouldn't talk to you. It might be dangerous for you. Olya, no. I've got to go.
All over Leningrad they lie, frozen in the hours before dawn, listening for the knock that comes to other doors, but never, surely never to your own. Not to you, with your next promotion on its way, and the holiday in the Crimea planned, and little Mitya's 4th birthday next week.
Even Anna's boss, that perfect supplier of statistics and ever-ready follower of party directives, even Elizaveta Antonovna, was grey with terror that February 4 years ago, after Stalin's speech to the Central Committee. Wreckers, traitors, enemies and saboteurs were not only to be found in the opposition. They had infiltrated the party itself and were among its elite, masking themselves as irreproachable party activists and committee members. But how could you ever prove it wasn't a mask, Anna wonders? Only by ripping off your own flesh.
Behind Anna, Kolya stirs. He sits up, instantly wide awake.
I want to come with you. You know you can't. We talked about it yesterday. I'll be so quiet she won't even know I'm there.
No, Kolya. Marina Petrovna hasn't asked you.
And anyway, you're going fishing with Dad, aren't you?
He'd forgotten that. She watches the two pleasures fight in his face.
And when I come back, you can show me what you've caught. You're better at catching fish than Dad.
You'll be fine. Just don't let the fish see your shadow.
Why not?
Because if he sees your shadow, he knows you're waiting to catch him.
Anna?
What?
I won't move. I'll be so still the fish will think I'm a tree. Like this.
He lies perfectly still, with his hands crossed over his chest. Anna is about to tiptoe out of the room, but somehow she can't leave him like this, lying on his back with his hands folded, so still. It looks wrong. Unnatural.
Kolya?
He springs up, glaring at her.
I shut my eyes so you could go. You keep saying goodbye and you never go. I hate it when you do that.
Chapter 3
The track narrows to a path. She's going to have to get off her bike. Birch, bird cherry and larch have given way to the deep green gloom of fir, and the trees meet overhead. Anna dismounts and takes out the sheet of directions her father has written down for her.
Turn left at the Tutayev farm, and watch out for the dogs. Then carry on for about 6 kilometres until you come to the crossroads.
He was right about the dogs. 2 Alsatians ran out after her, snarling and snapping round her wheels. But they were half-starved and couldn't run fast enough to catch her as she raced downhill away from the farm. What if she'd had Collier on the back, with his plump legs hanging down and his weight slowing them just enough for the dogs to outrun them? She must remember to go back another way. There should be a wooden gate in the wall which runs along the track here. The wall is crumbling, held together by moss, ivy and creeping tendrils of bramble. She could climb it, but that would mean leaving her bike. She'd better keep going. Anna half lifts, half pushes her bike. The sun is hot now, and under the canopy of firs the air is warm, resinous and sleepy. You could lie down here, with your head on a cushion of pine needles, where the tree's roots arch above the forest floor, like arthritic fingers playing the piano. You could shut your eyes.
Anna never gets enough sleep. There's Collier to rouse and wash and dress. He ought to do it himself,
but there isn't enough time. She makes his porridge, tidies round, and does some washing if there's time.
Her father never wakes. He sleeps like a stone in the mornings, in a thick, dead sleep that doesn't refresh him.
It's not surprising, since he's up most of the night. She hears him moving about, a shuffle from room to room, very quiet, so as not to wake anyone. The clink of a glass, a cough, a sigh. Sometimes she could swear she hears the pages of his book turning as she listens, frozen and on edge, unable to go back to sleep herself, because it feels as if she's abandoning him. And then for a long time, as much as an hour sometimes, he doesn't move at all. She pictures him sitting there, head bowed towards his chest, book slipping to the floor, worn out and sleepless, with a glass of tea cooling by his side. But she must get some sleep. She's got work in the morning. She has to be at the nursery by 7. She sets the tables, scrubs the little toilets that Luba never cleans properly, checks menus and food deliveries, and does as many of the dozen jobs on the list inside her head as she can before the children start to arrive at 7:30. And here they come, 6 of them, 7, a dozen, 15, a flood of little bodies packed into padded trousers, jackets, caps and boots, swaying sleepily on their feet and quite unable to take off their own boots or put their jackets on the correct pegs. Their mothers have been up since 5, and even so they'll be late if they don't rush off now, this minute, unpeeling the hands of little Vasya or Maya, who clings on tight to Mammy's legs and won't let go without a screaming session. Above the din, Anna says, over and over again, "Don't worry, he'll be fine as soon as you've gone. I promise you, he'll be smiling again in 5 minutes. If only I keep my job here. If only I can keep Collier with me." All day Anna deals with runny noses, tired tears, biting and hair-pulling, lessons in hygienic hand-washing and socialisation at playtime. Demarcation lines are strict. Anna is an unqualified nursery assistant, not a teacher. Elizaveta Antonovna Zamirovsky, with her pedagogical qualifications and anxious, pedantic sticking to theory, never forgets for one instant that she is the expert and she is in charge. "I have to deliver the type of education which will develop the children's concept of Soviet citizenship to its full extent. I don't expect you to understand the nature of that responsibility, Anna Mikhailovna, but I do expect you to cooperate with it to the best of your ability." "Allow me to assure you of my fullest cooperation, Elizaveta Antonovna," Anna shouts back eagerly whenever this speech comes round, as it does 2 or 3 times a month. She has realized some time ago that Elizaveta Antonovna lacks confidence for all her degrees. She needs bolstering, and the best way for Anna to do this is to assume the manner of a zealous factory forewoman receiving her morning orders. "And may I report that the children's toilets are still overflowing? I don't think that plumber we had last week was much good." But after all, Poor Elizaveta Antonovna, it's a struggle for her. She doesn't like the children much, and they don't like her at all. Anna is becoming anxious. Still the same crumbling wall, still no gate. Maybe Marina Petrovna never meant her to find the place. It isn't going to happen. No need to have selected and sharpened her drawing pencils so carefully, and spent so much more of her wages than they could afford on a new block of drawing paper. And all this because her father had written about Anna's work in one of his letters to Marina Petrovna. He was too conscious that she'd had to leave school to take care of Kolya, and he tried to make up for it with praise and encouragement that sounded false in her ears. He thought she was turning into a worker bee. But wasn't that what he wanted and needed? Anna to queue for him and mend Kolya's clothes and run from shop to shop until she got hold of fresh milk. "You've got real talent, Anna. You must develop it." "Yes, for getting hold of an extra 100 grams of sausage." But she didn't say it aloud. What was the use of talent without training? She was making no progress at all. Her technique was poor. What she needed to learn could never be learned in spare moments in between her job and the house and Kolya. She needed teachers. She needed contemporaries who would drive her on. But then, did she need to learn to be national in form, socialist in content? Without telling her, Mikhail packed up Anna's pen and ink portrait of Kolya and her pencil sketches of Lyuba working in the nursery kitchen and sent them to Marina Petrovna. "What did you do that for?" Anna shouted at him when she found out. "You should have asked me first. I'm not a child." The flare of humiliation surprised her. Suddenly she hated that portrait of Kolya, which was the best thing she'd done. She wanted to disown it, and the sketches too. But then Marina Petrovna sent the work back, padded and packed with extreme care, as if Anna's drawings were rubies. With it there came a letter. She'd liked Anna's work. Would Anna accept a commission? Because if so, Marina Petrovna would very much like Anna to come and draw her. "Draw, Marina Petrovna? My technique's not good enough. I'm an amateur, can't she tell that? I can't even afford materials." Again, her father's hurt, conscious look. He thinks she's blaming him because he contributes so little to the household now. "No," she says, "all I meant was..." and breaks off. What's the point? One circle of her father's pain only leads down to another.